This is the Clinical Pharmacology Podcast with Nathan Tuescher, where I discuss clinical pharmacology and pharmacometrics topics from the perspective of drug development scientists. Today's podcast will have two parts. First, I will discuss hepatic impairment clinical studies using the guidance documents from both the US FDA and the EMA. I have included links to the guidance documents for both organizations in the show notes. I will cover the rationale behind studies in patients with hepatic impairment, common study designs, and key factors in the analysis and interpretation of the study results. After I discuss pharmacokinetics in patients with hepatic impairment, I have a big announcement, so keep listening to the entire podcast. The evaluation of pharmacokinetics in patients with hepatic impairment is critical during a drug development program. Hepatic impairment generally refers to a reduced capacity of the liver to eliminate drugs via metabolic processes. The liver is a critical organ in the body that has a vital role in the metabolism of toxins in the body. This includes metabolism of most drug products that we administer for therapeutic benefit. Nearly all of the activity of cytochrome P450 enzymes and even glucuronides takes place in the liver. In fact, any orally administered drug passes through the liver before it even reaches the systemic circulation. Therefore, the liver is a critical organ that can dramatically impact the pharmacokinetics of a drug product. There are many causes of impaired hepatic function. Some are genetic, some are due to viral diseases, and some are due to chronic lifestyle choices like alcohol or overeating. Regardless of the cause, a reduction in hepatic function can lead to a reduction in the ability of the body to metabolize drug products. This usually results in lower clearance values and ultimately higher systemic exposures. Thus, just as with renal dysfunction, hepatic impairment can lead to toxicity for patients. But there are some significant differences between renal and hepatic dysfunction. With the kidney, changes in renal function are monitored by changes in the ability to excrete specific substances like creatinine. Changes in creatinine appear to be directly correlated with the ability of the kidney to excrete other drug products. However, hepatic function does not have a similar single marker for its function. There are measures such as albumin, bilirubin, ALT, AST, ALP, and prothrombin time that can give an idea of the overall liver function. However, none of these can accurately represent all of the functional capacity of the liver. And despite multiple efforts, no group of measurements has been accepted as representative of the overall function of the liver with respect to pharmacokinetics. Thus, unlike renal impairment studies that rely on a single biomarker for patient stratification, hepatic impairment requires more clinical interpretation for patient stratification. I'll speak more about the stratification later in the podcast. Both the FDA and EMA have similar recommendations on when you need to conduct a clinical study in patients with hepatic impairment. These recommendations are as follows. 1. The intended patient population is likely to include individuals with hepatic impairment. 2. Hepatic metabolism is involved in the clearance of the drug or its metabolites. And 3. The drug is intended to be administered more than once. These three criteria cover a vast majority of drug products in development, but let me give you some examples of drugs that likely do not need a hepatic impairment study. A drug for which elimination is primarily via the lungs. A drug that is almost exclusively eliminated via renal filtration. A drug that is intended for single administration, like an emergency rescue medication. A drug that is applied topically and has little or no systemic exposure. And a drug that is contraindicated in patients with hepatic impairment. If you want to get a waiver for a hepatic impairment clinical study, it is recommended that you discuss that with the regulatory team during your end of phase 2 meeting. At this point, you will have adequate information about both the metabolism of your drug in humans and a clearly identified target patient population. Attempts to get a waiver without both the metabolic profile and the target patients will usually be deferred until you have that information available. If you need to conduct a study or a clinical study in patients with hepatic impairment, there are a few critical details that you should remember. First, although we call participants in these studies patients with hepatic impairment, they do not have to be patients with the same disease or indication that you are treating in your phase 2 and phase 3 studies. The term patient is used in this context to only differ from healthy volunteer, because anyone with hepatic impairment is not a healthy volunteer, so they're a patient. So let's say your intended patient population is heart disease. When you conduct your hepatic impairment study, the participants in that study do not have to have heart disease. And in fact, you probably don't want patients with both heart disease and hepatic impairment in your study if possible. Second is the classification system used for patients with hepatic impairment in the study. The Child-Pugh classification system is used to categorize patients with hepatic impairment as mild, moderate, or severe. Other classification approaches require prior approval from regulators. In fact, I've never seen any other classification system used for hepatic impairment studies. The Child-Pugh system includes 5 different measures. 3 are biomarkers: bilirubin, albumin, and prothrombin time, while the other 2 are clinical observations of encephalopathy and ascites. Unfortunately, these latter 2 clinical observations are rarely performed unless an individual is being specifically treated for liver disease. Thus, most subjects in your previous clinical studies will not have the information necessary available to categorize them using the Child-Pugh system. This often prevents the early assessment of potential impact of hepatic impairment using phase 1b or phase 2 data. You can get an idea using the biomarkers, but the lack of the clinical assessments for encephalopathy and ascites prevents clear extrapolation of those early results to a dedicated study. This is also why standalone clinical studies are almost always performed for hepatic impairment, where renal impairment may be assessed using population pharmacokinetic methods. The FDA recommends 1 of 2 designs, either a full design or a reduced design. The EMA recommends using what's called the reduced design. The full design study includes 4 treatment groups: mild, moderate, and severe hepatic impairment, and then the 4th is a control group of healthy volunteers. Each group should contain at least 6 subjects with evaluable data. In many cases, 8 subjects are enrolled in each group to ensure that there are at least 6 with complete data sets. The participants in the control group should be generally similar to the participants in the hepatic impairment groups with respect to age, weight, and sex. Obviously, with only 8 participants in the control group and 24 in the hepatic impairment groups, you can't do a one-to-one match, but you should attempt to get a reasonably similar distribution. If there are other demographic factors that are important for the PK of your drug, such as metabolic phenotype, you should also balance for those other factors. The reduced design is a stepwise study. In the first phase, only 2 treatment groups are enrolled. If an effect is observed, additional treatment groups can be enrolled for further evaluation. The 2 initial treatment groups are moderate hepatic impairment and controls. If a significant effect is observed in the moderate hepatic impairment group, then enrolling participants with mild and severe disease is recommended to further understand the impact. If no significant effect is observed, then your study can be considered complete. However, your label may only reflect the results that include a moderate impairment group. If you want to make claims about the severe impairment group, you will need to enroll those participants in the study. The reduced design is currently preferred by most drug development companies because of the expenses and difficulty associated with recruiting participants into the full studies. The mild impairment group rarely shows a difference from the controls, thus spending time and effort and money to enroll those participants rarely provides any benefit. but the severe impairment group is often very difficult to enroll due to the paucity of participants with that level of liver disease and without significant comorbidities that impact overall health. Thus, many drug companies are willing to accept the labeling limitations by not evaluating patients with severe impairment unless that group of patients is expected to make up a large portion of the target patient population. These studies are nearly always conducted as a single-dose study. However, multiple doses may be required if the drug or its metabolites is known to exhibit nonlinear or time-dependent pharmacokinetics. If a multiple dose study is conducted, be sure to use lower doses to prevent accumulation to unsafe levels in participants with hepatic impairment. I have always run single dose hepatic impairment studies, but I'm sure there are a few cases where multiple doses were needed by some drug developers. A rich PK sampling profile should be used such that the individual PK parameters can be calculated using non-compartmental analysis techniques. You will want to extend the sampling period beyond what healthy volunteers might use to capture the possible slower clearance in the patients with hepatic impairment. I recommend staying with 12 to 15 samples, but you may want to redistribute the samples across a time range that is 2 to 3 times longer than you would for healthy volunteers. One thing you can do is take the terminal half-life in healthy volunteers and multiply it by 3 to get a new possible terminal half-life. Then use that new half-life to build your sampling scheme. Use PK modeling to project when concentrations will be below the limit of quantitation with different clearance values, which can be very useful in planning your sampling strategy. It is recommended to use the same sampling strategy on all treatment groups. The concentration time data should be analyzed to calculate the total exposure, or AUC, and the peak exposure, or Cmax, for each individual subject. Comparisons of these values relative to the control group can be used to estimate the magnitude of the impact of hepatic impairment on PK exposure. Often, an estimate of the relative exposure in 90% confidence intervals, similar to what you would do on a bioequivalence analysis, will be performed. The same no effect boundaries of 80 to 125% can be used to claim a lack of effect within a specific impairment group. Specific recommendations for dosing adjustments can be difficult due to the heterogeneity of liver diseases and the small numbers of participants in these clinical studies. The FDA guidance includes specific language that can be used in a variety of situations. However, it is likely that you will negotiate that language with the FDA during the NDA review process. All right, that wraps up the hepatic impairment guidance information. As a quick review, I gave an overview of why we study PK in patients with hepatic impairment, described the clinical study designs and enrollment groups, discussed the Child-Pugh classification system, and I also gave some suggestions on PK sampling schedules for hepatic impairment clinical studies and the data analysis approach. I hope this information helps you plan your next hepatic impairment study. Now, I'd like to take some time to share a big announcement. I have been working for some time on a new project, and I'm really thrilled to tell you about it. I've been analyzing pharmacokinetic data for nearly 25 years, and I've always felt that the tools that we have for analysis are a bit rudimentary and sometimes overly complicated. Specifically, non-compartmental analysis methods have not changed for over 50 years, yet our software tools don't reflect advancements in technology and ease of use. So last year, I built a team to begin developing a new software tool for non-compartmental analysis. But this is unlike anything you've ever used before. It is a lightning-fast pharmacokinetic analysis and reporting tool. For reference, it can complete a PK analysis including parameter calculation, creation of individual and summary plots, and data summarization for 100 subject profiles in less than 90 seconds. This is a fully cloud-based solution with embedded version controls and the top modern security protocols. And the best part is there is absolutely no software to install and no coding needed. It is as simple as selecting your data set, specifying the route of administration and dosing frequency, and then clicking the execute button. Within about a minute, You'll be able to download the individually calculated PK parameters, summary statistics for all those parameters, individual plots on linear and semi-logarithmic axes, individual terminal elimination plots, summary profile plots, and even a technical report with all of the analysis details and results. This can even be automated and integrated into other workflows your company may have for data processing. If you look at the podcast, it actually took me longer to explain what you get when you run an analysis than it actually takes to do the analysis and get the results. So I'm really excited about this, and I think this will really advance our discipline and allow us to understand and analyze results without spending as much time doing the data analysis itself. If you want to know more, please go to the website at Aplos Analytics and fill out the contact form. Again, that website is aplosanalytics.com. I've included a link in the show notes. For those listening in March 2024, I will be attending the ASCPT conference in Colorado later this week and giving demonstrations of this new lightning fast PK analysis tool. If you would like to see a demo, please send me a message via the aplosanalytics.com website or contact me on LinkedIn. I'd love to show you how this works and get your feedback. We plan on opening a free early access program in May 2024, where users can get free access to the platform, and you'll be able to provide feedback to my software development team. This has been a huge effort by the software development team, and I'm really excited about our progress. I'm confident that this tool can be critical in allowing pharmacokinetic analysts to spend more time interpreting data results instead of generating those results. And this isn't just for PK analysts. Bioanalytical labs can use this to quickly generate PK results from the concentration time data. Biostatisticians can use this to generate PK parameters from their PC datasets after database lock. This new tool can permit many more people to easily and quickly generate PK analysis results from concentration time data. So I hope you connect with me at aplosanalytics.com and take a look at our solution. Thank you very much for listening to my podcast and allowing me to share this exciting news. Have a great week, and I look forward to seeing many of you at the ASCPT meeting in Colorado. For more information, please connect with me on LinkedIn, send me an email to nathan@tushersolutions.com, or sign up for my newsletter at tushersolutions.com/newsletter. The newsletter is a copy of the show notes sent to your email each time an episode is released. Also, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to the show. Thank you.